evening and welcome to this new episode of the podcast series Other Side Europe, which is being coordinated by Agora Europe. This podcast series includes several other institutions and features video interviews and webinars with scholars, practitioners, representatives, cultural actors, athletes, citizens, residents, and migrants from several cross-border areas on different topics, including sea rescue, but as well other topics in relation with migrations. Speaking about sea rescue today, on the occasion of the International Human Rights Day, we will have, for this new episode, a conversation with Sophie Weidenhiller from CI, who's currently in Vienna, Austria, and Titus Molkenboer from United for Rescue, who's currently in Berlin, Germany. And we are also joined by Caterina Di Fazio, who's currently based in Hendaye at the Basque border, and who's the founder of Agora Europe and its president, as well as a postdoc at Studio Europa, Maastricht University. Over to you, Caterina.
Thanks so much, Virginie. I'm Virginie Lefebvre, secretary of Agora Europe, and she's joining us from Beirut in Lebanon on the Eastern Mediterranean border. And welcome to Titus, welcome Sophie. It's nice to have you there and to talk about sea rescue with you.
Good to be here.
Hi, welcome.
So we'll start with our first question. Since we're December 10th, we would like you to comment on the importance of human rights, on the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, and the respect and the protection of human rights, in particular when it comes to the situation of persons in exile. So over to you, Sophie, to kick off the discussion on this topic.
Today is a day of human rights, and I think that's a really good point to start discussing all of the human rights violations that are ongoing also in Europe, because I think as Europeans, we sometimes like to point out all the human rights violations that are happening in other countries. And we're sometimes not willing to face the troubles and the issues that we've actually created for so many people right here in Europe, right at our borders. And maybe Titus, you can tell us a bit more, because I think you're an expert on this issue as well.
I wouldn't go so far, but first of all, thank you. Thank you, Virginie. Thank you, Caterina, for having me. I think human rights are the center of our argument, of the search and rescue argument. I mean, we basically say that international law requires people to be brought to a place of safety, and that the universal human rights of every person need to be respected. You know, so I think we particularly need to maintain these universal rights. But at the same time, it's, you know, I have to agree with Sophie, like, there hasn't been a single day in the last years where international law and human rights of people have not been violated at the European borders. So I think it brings up a very big question of, how we as Europeans can go out in the world and say we bring human rights and democracy and all these values to the world when we are breaking them every day at our borders, in our societies, and outside of our borders. So it's a sad day, but it's also, you know, a good day, because I think there are so many people fighting for human rights still today.
Yeah, it's also like European history in a sense. So, Sophie, thanks so much for having joined, and it's nice to finally see you. And you're the spokesperson for CI, an NGO based in Germany. I just wanted you to introduce us to CI for those who are not acquainted with your activities and so on. Also by the book, I mean, we've known a lot about the Alan Kurdi. We know that there's a new book now. Yeah, anything you want to share with us on CI? Thanks.
Yeah, I know that names can be a little bit confusing sometimes, but we're actually called CI. That's the name of our organization. It is a German-based NGO that is mostly financed through private donations. And we have two boats now. And the one that is most famous is the one that's called Alan Kurdi, to commemorate the tragedy of Alan Kurdi's family. Because, as most of you probably know, Alan Kurdi was a little boy who actually died at our borders alongside his brother Ghalib and his mother Rehani. So that was the intention behind the name, to really, to force people to remember him and, you know, symbolically remember all the other people that have died in the past years. The Alan Kurdi has successfully rescued a lot of people, but is unfortunately currently detained again in Italy. And as a reaction to all these new policies and strategies that are being implemented by the European Union and the state actors, we have decided that we have to actually grow as an organization, that we have to improve the way we work, that we can't just give in or give up. We'll do the opposite. We'll expand, and that's when we've decided to buy a new ship, effectively with the great help of United for Rescue. I have to mention that as well. And we've now also partnered up with MOAS, which is an organization that has. They were the first, actually, I think, to conduct civil sea rescue in 2014 in the Med. And they're very professional, and we're very happy about this collaboration, because the way that things are right now, it seems like things aren't improving at all from the state side. So we just have to, you know, try and improve things on our side and be better and somehow managed to be able to save more lives and to stay operational. So we have now two ships that are operational, but one is being detained still in Italy, and the other ship is currently being prepared for its first mission. It's called CI4, and missions are supposed to start in February of 2021.
Thanks, Sophie.
Thanks, Sophie. Titus, we would like you as well to present your organization, United for Rescue, and as well the context of its response and its current status. Over to you, Titus.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. So I might take a step back to maybe explain the background a bit more. So in 2016, I became a founding member of another NGO that was called Jugendrettet. And with our little ship Juventa, we managed to rescue 14,000 people in the span of 2 years, until the ship was, detained by the Italian government under very, murky and very questionable legal means. And I think United for Rescue is in some ways a learning from the ongoing criminalization of search and rescue activities. So it actually stems from a initiative by the Protestant Church in Germany from 2019, where they said in their big biannual meeting, we're going to send a ship. And after that, they needed to follow up on that claim. And the solution they came up with was United for Rescue, which on the one hand is building a very big coalition of civil society organizations, exactly doing what we learned from 2017 onwards, that we need to have political support in our societies in order to, be protected against this criminalization. And on the other hand, is meant to do fundraising for the search and rescue community, exactly from that point as well, that we need structural and long-term funding for these organizations to continue doing their job. So that's what we've been doing. We financed the Sea-Watch at the beginning of this year, which has also been detained by the Italian government. Since August of this year, and we now managed to fundraise some more money to also support CI with an ongoing campaign. As I said, it's all based on the idea that we need to have structural and long-term support, because the work that these actors, and I know from my own perspective how important it is incredibly important, and they're doing such an amazing job, and we want to support them in that.
Nice, Titus. Thank you so much. I think it's very important when we're talking about sea rescue and operation at sea to show how it is not, linked to any particular political belief or value. And it's not linked to any kind of ideology, really. It's really about saving human lives at sea. I wanted to go back to something we were mentioning, Sophie, but also Titus. So the situation of many boats, not only CI, right now in the Mediterranean, this situation of detention, as we said, and the idea that there is still some kind of something that we call criminalization of solidarity and criminalization of sea rescue, despite the fact that, of course, international law and the law of sea, you know, and even before laws existed, we all think that, yeah, saving lives at sea is just a duty. And it's, it just comes with knowing the sea and knowing what we should do as human beings.
Sophie, do you wanna add some that?
All right. Yeah, you're right. And I think if you ask any seafarer, any professional sailor, they will tell you the same thing, that saving someone in distress at sea, that was never even a question. You know, the only question was who is going to save them, and you know, how fast can we get there. But it was never about should we save a human life at sea or should we not. I mean, it's quite absurd in and of itself. But yeah, I've thought a lot about it and what's happened recently, because I feel that the way that criminalization now is happening has shifted a bit, because since the change in government in Italy, you can see that it's not so much an outright approach of criminalization, of really putting sea rescuers in jail. It's more of a covert and more bureaucratic approach that is currently being used. But the effects are still the same. And actually, I think that the policies that are now in effect, or the tactics, if you will, are in a way even more effective, because blocking a whole organization, blocking a whole ship is even more effective than just putting one captain in jail. So what we've seen is that instead of, you know, suing singular people, what's happening now is that ships get detained systematically, you'd have to say, because it's not just one ship. It's all of the ships basically in Italy have been detained for pretty much the same absurd reasons. I mean, it's crazy when you read some of the accusations of the port state authorities, which are the authorities that are detaining the ships. You read things like, we don't have enough life vests. We have too many life vests aboard, and we don't have enough toilets. You know, I mean, that's not only absurd, that's even macabre to say we carry too many life vests. And it's just a strategic approach to prevent us from saving lives, and not just CI, but all of the sea rescue organizations, because other commercial vessels, they don't face the same difficulties at all, right? And we've even found out that the people who write those reports are always the same people. They like fly from one port to the other and write the same reports. So it's quite a strange tactic, but it's very effective. And another thing that I want to mention is that also the German flag state, which is actually responsible for our ship, because it is a German ship under German flag, they don't condone this at all. They don't agree with the authorities there at all, and neither do the Spanish authorities, which have also said that the ship is fine. You know, we've fixed everything that we needed to fix during all the scheduled maintenance work. So, still the problem was that we were detained again after the last rescue, and they're just trying to keep the ships in port as long as possible, which is for us very detrimental, because anyone who knows a bit about ships knows that even if you're just in port and you're not able to leave the port, you still pay a lot of money just to stay there and for maintenance. It's a big problem. And our reaction to this was now to buy a bigger ship that's better equipped with like different specificities, so it's hopefully gonna work out a lot better than with the other ships. So we're constantly trying to improve and evolve as a reaction to this. And Titus, do you want to add something?
Before Titus adds something, maybe, I don't know if there's any technical issue there, because it seems a little frozen there. I just wanted to say that we had time to discuss kind of the same issues with Sea Watch, and in particular with Sea Watch Italy, for Sea Watch 4, And we had the time to discuss all of this also with Salvamento Marittimo Humanitario. We know that Aita Mari just left the port of Pasaida, Libane. I think she's going to be back with us. Yes, there.
Sorry, I lost connection.
There's no problem. Absolutely no problem. And they were saying how the Spanish state actually guarantees for, you know, is a guarantor for Spanish boats, which is not the case for all boats. And of course, we're saying it's detrimental because everyone that knows a little bit about ships and sailing and so on knows that even just leaving them in a port is bad for the boat. Like the conditions obviously deteriorate, but also it's bad for what's going on with people, you know, because no one is to rescue them. And then there is this legend of people are only going to leave if they know that there's an NGO boat somewhere. But look at what's happening in the Atlantic. I mean, seriously, there's no NGO boat in the Atlantic, as we know. And still people are leaving constantly every day and more and more.
Yeah, it's incredibly cynical because I've talked to many of the refugees, and what I've heard over and over again is that they said, I know that I could die at sea, but I would rather die free at sea than be a slave forever in Libya, or, you know, be shot or tortured to death in those camps in Libya. So, you know,
can I add two things to that? So I think one thing that I would like to add is it's not just an Italian phenomenon. I think we've seen the criminalization of humanitarian aid workers and activists throughout Europe, and especially in the countries that are hotspots for, you know, irregular migration, which are, you know, the Balkan states and Greece, Italy, Spain. And I think the much bigger question, which you touched upon, is why is this happening? You know, because I think if you ask anybody on the street, it's like, should we let people die? Most people would say, no, we should not. You know, so generally, the idea is that, you know, humanitarianism or humanitarian considerations trump politics. It should stand outside it. So why are these, you know, NGOs criminalized and have been criminalized for the last 3 to 4 years? And I think the much bigger point is that, yes, we are saving lives. But I think the more important part is that we are bringing these people to Europe and guarantee their universal right, or their right, their guaranteed right to asylum, to an asylum process. And I think at that point, we have to say the entire European strategy is predicated on the idea of deterrence, of keeping people away and not having them reach European shores. And that happens in a variety of ways, which are incredibly horrendous results in, you know, countries of origin, also in transit states where we, you know, bolster dictatorships and other horrible regimes to keep people away. And it eventually also leads to, you know, the criminalization of rescue. So I think this is something we have to make very clear, is that, yes, the reason why these ships are out there is to rescue lives. But the much bigger part is that we are also, by rescuing people and by bringing them here, we're also undermining the deterrence regime of European borders. And I think that is a decidedly political stance that these NGOs are, you know, and are more and more taking, to say that this is an unjust system and we need to work against it.
Yeah, and that's a very important point. And it is systematic. It's not just a reaction to certain events. This is something that's been planned for years or even decades. And it has a lot to do with also foreign policies. And for example, even like development, like aid money is being tied to border control and border protection policies in African countries to prevent people from even, you know, crossing to Europe and things like that. So I think that it is definitely also a political issue, and it's a systemic issue. It's something that's planned, and that there's an agenda behind it.
Thanks, Sophie, and thanks, Titus. Going now to the situation at the field or at the sea level, could you please describe for us what is, according to your knowledge, the situation in the central Mediterranean? Over to you, Titus or Sophie, whoever feels more comfortable in addressing this particular topic.
I think Sophie's much more in the topic right now, as they're actually much closer to the field, but I'm happy to add something. that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, you've mentioned it before, Katharina, it's the problem is that people flee no matter what because they have really urgent reasons to leave their countries. And for example, most of the people that we've saved so far, they leave from Libya, and Libya is still a country of civil war. So everyone who's leaving Libya is fleeing from a country of war. If you could see it like that, right? And people still have lots of reasons to flee. There's so much conflict going on, so many issues, and as long as those are not being resolved, people will continue to cross the Central Mediterranean Sea, and they're going to continue to drown. And another problem is that now, for example, in winter, weather conditions are even getting worse and worse. I remember I was on a mission in December and January once in 2019, and sometimes in the Med you have 4-meter waves and people still go out. So a boat like the people use would just capsize in a matter of minutes if there's even like half a meter or a meter of wave. So yeah, the dying still continues. And just because there are no ships to rescue those people and there's not adequate monitoring doesn't mean that it's not happening.
I think to maybe add to that, I actually took the time to look at the numbers before coming here. So I think all in all, since January of this year, approximately 160,000 people came over the Mediterranean as a whole. 34,000 of which came over the Central Mediterranean Sea. I think that number, those are the first numbers, and the second figures, I think they're important, that more than 11,000 people have been returned to Libya by the so-called Libyan Coast Guard, which is essentially an armed militia that is in nowhere near the standards that we should. It's just a horrible organization, and they're being funded by the European Union. So I think what's important here is to say 160,000 people in 1 year is not a crisis. We're nowhere near crisis levels since in 2015. So the fact that the European Union does not react any different to than they did in 2015 is shows how horrendous and how they don't have any policy agenda truly apart from trying to deter people. And I think secondly, it just shows how much their approach is in essence also working, because those 11,000 people would have normally haven't had the chance to get to Europe and ask for asylum, but now they're being returned to Libya by the Libyan Coast Guard, which is in essence a pushback just via proxy.
Thanks so much, Titus. And I was thinking about, there's this competition in sailing right now. It's called the Vendée Globe. It's very important in France. Like, technically, it's globally important. And it's, lone sailors that actually travel around the world. And there was an operation sea rescue done by one of the competitors, Jean Lecam. And, and the guy, after he saved his, his contendant, said, performing sea rescue, saving people at sea, is just part of our job. It's not even about like law or anything. So I was thinking about that and how like this is a perspective that really we can share with pretty much anyone knowing the sea and any sailor really. And it comes before law and it comes before political positions, although of course what we're doing is also making a political statement. And in relation to that, we've been discussed with Titus, of course, also, a lot about policies of externalization of borders. And we're seeing in the last few interviews how these policies of externalization of borders also entail changes in migratory routes, reopening and reclosing the different migratory routes. But there's still like something that is very common in all of those. So I wanted both of you, maybe starting from Titus, as this long-term topic for us, to discuss this too.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I'd much rather talk about this with you drinking a wine like we did in Italy, but this must work. I think, again, just to take a step back, I think it's really important to say that like the people who are dying at Europe's sea and the fact that people are dying at Europe's borders is not a crisis. It's not an accident. It's, it's the result of decades of European policy measures that have the specific aim to deter people based on the idea that the most effective way to limit asylum seekers is to prevent them from arriving in Europe in the first place. That is the heart of what Europe is doing. And of course, you know, the policies take on different means, but one is, you know, pushbacks, working with governments in the global south, especially in the, you know, Middle East and the Northern African states, to keep people there, to take them back, and doing these, you know, EU-Turkey deal style arrangements with many other countries. And I think the most central part is that I would always say in this regard is migration is natural. People will move. People move for a variety of reasons. One of them being flight, but there's so many other reasons why people move, and it's really hard to entangle these different forms of migration. So people are going to move and they're going to try. And of course, that's going to find their way. And as we see in the Canary Islands, I think that's what you're referring to right now, there will be spikes in migration flows when these makeshift arrangements that the EU puts in place, thinking that they are sustainable solutions, eventually break down. I think I also looked at the numbers for the Canary Islands, and I think in 2019, 1,490 people arrived there. And to this day in 2020, it's been already more than 16,000 people. So that's, you know, more than 1,000% increase. It's crazy. So obviously that leads to horrendous conditions on these islands. But again, it also is crazy how the European governments are saying, oh my God, this is a crisis. We could not have foreseen this. While every single migration researcher and activist would have told them this is going to happen eventually. Similar to how 2015 is presented as a crisis, a unique crisis, where most people were saying, well, we have been waiting for this because it was obviously going to happen. So I think, yeah, to you know, come around is, as I said earlier, the European Union does not have a plan. The only plan that they have is deterrence, and they do this with the most violent means, and we see the horrible results everywhere. Sorry, Sophie, I feel like that was very long.
No, but it was very accurate. I can only agree. Yeah, and what's also interesting is to me the way that it's being done, because for example, you mentioned pushbacks. There for a great deal of pushbacks is actually being what I call outsourced to the Libyan Coast Guard, right? So it's a very covert way of trying to deter people, but also conduct pushbacks and all of it's very it's not like open warfare, you know, but really when you break it down, the European Union instead of combating reasons why people have to leave their countries in the first place, they're fighting the people themselves, and that of course will never work and is also, you know, not an ethically correct way to do things anyway, but it just doesn't work. And it's not only ethically horrible to do this, but it's also very, very ineffective. And so we really have to ask ourselves, why are we actually doing this? What's the real reason why we're doing this? Is it just for political gain or what's the reasoning here? It's not only unethical, it's also illogical, if you ask me.
So over the past weeks, we've been talking a lot about the so-called new EU pact on migration and asylum. And we wanted to take today's interview with you, the opportunity of today's interview, to give you the opportunity to comment on this specific pact. And I think, and maybe we'll go first with you, Titus. I think you've been writing something with one of our partner organization, European Alternatives. So maybe you want to link it up with also your perspective on this new EU pact. Over to you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I'll try my best to summarize it. Okay. So I think what's important is to say that the EU Migration Pact, A, was always going to fail, and B, does not contain anything substantial or new. And it's that's it. I think we have to acknowledge that Orban and the Visegrad states in Europe basically want to end the right to asylum. And they basically Austria. And Austria, fair enough. Yeah. Vasily Bassancourt is definitely not a hero. So they want to put the axe to international law, to the Geneva Convention, and just get rid of the right to asylum. Even if they don't say it outright, that's what it means. What they want. So I believe Ursula von der Leyen and the Commission, to some extent, that they try to find a compromise. But I think you have to acknowledge that trying to find a compromise between that position and, you know, maybe the German position, which is still horrible, is also going to have a horrible result. You know, it's not going to result in anything positive in terms of human rights, in terms of the treatment of migrants, but also in just, you know, general basic decency. I think it's also important to say, as I said earlier, 160,000 people arrived irregularly via the Mediterranean Sea this year, 20,000 or something via the Atlantic. So it's not like we have a crisis level in the richest continent in the world with more than 500 million people. So I think it's essential to say this is not a crisis. There is a solution to this. It's just that the member states are unwilling to even think about and engage in a positive dialogue, which is really frustrating, especially to us. And that would be the piece that I've written for European Alternatives, is that we do see this Europe from below. We see tremendous political action. We see movements, you know, stepping up in the Greek islands, in Germany, in all the other European countries who say, look, we want to welcome people. We have done so in the past. We will continue to do so. Listen to us. I think in Germany, more than 200 cities and municipalities say, in the Seebrücke movement, we're safe harbors. We are willing to welcome people. Yet these efforts are continuously, again and again, being frustrated by politicians, in this case, the Minister of Interior, Horst Seehofer, who is obviously conservative. So I think, to sum it up, the ongoing deaths in the Mediterranean Sea are not an accident. They're the result of institutionalized policy, and we need to dismantle these institutions. And that's going to take time and political action and political alliance building. And we need to somehow amass political power to do that. And I think the sort of silver lining that we have is these municipalities, is people on the ground who are already working for a Europe of solidarity. The EU Migration Pact and the actions of the member states are definitely the opposite.
Thanks a lot, Titus. Sophie, closing words.
Yes, well, on the pact, I can also say that I think it's nothing but a farce, because we have existing laws. We have human rights laws. We have the UNCLOS, the maritime law, international law. So the only problem is that state actors are not abiding by existing laws. So I don't know if new laws are going to change anything. And especially the option. Yeah, well, and this point that was pushed, like you said, especially by the Visegrad states and also by my home state, Austria, of, you know, refusing to partake in a distribution of displaced people, but rather conducting, deportations and pushbacks and things like that. That I mean, that's just absurd, right? And that's going to cause more problems than it solves, basically. And I also want to remind everyone that Europe was actually founded as a peace project after World War II. And I think we need to stick to our roots and work together, and we have to show solidarity. You know, the states of Europe have to show solidarity with each other. We all have to do our part. We all have to work together in this, but also, of course, show our solidarity with the people who don't already live in Europe, you know. And for example, we've all looked to America when the Black Lives Matter movement started. And I'm asking the people of Europe, well, where's our movement? You know, like, refugee lives matter, you know, displaced lives matter. Like, we should really, start and do something, because it's really necessary, because people are dying every day still.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much. Yes, I've been listening to a few people doing sea rescue saying, you know, Black Lives Matter movement should actually come out with some kind of statement about all of the black lives that we lose at sea. But as you just said, I think it's much more convincing that we should have our proper, you know, movement doing that.
Yeah.
Can I add something to that, though? Like, I think that's it's all true, but I think we also have to be a bit careful when doing that, when saying these things, because obviously we're four white people in this little Zoom room, and the problem is a lot of the time that these search and rescue movements, you know, are also very white, and we need to be very careful not to engage in this sort of white saviorism and sort of relieving our souls. And yeah, we're rescuing people, so we're the good guys. I think this is something that I think is really important to say. It's like the deaths in the Mediterranean Sea are just the latest very violent encounter of Europe with the global south. And it's not only built on decades of policies, but also centuries of, you know, capitalist extraction, colonialism, and horrific crimes like the transatlantic slave trade. So I think this is like, we as Europeans need to always frame what's happening out there in this context as it's being the result of Europe's original sin, which is, you know, the exploitation of the global south. And I think this is something we need to be very mindful about.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. At the same time, when you're looking at back at history, you know, slave trade, colonialism, and so on, those were all racialized phenomena. And we cannot, I think, you know, when we're looking at forced disappearances and forced displacement in the global south, coming to Europe and so on, we also need to be aware of the fact that, and our borders, that there are, racial phenomena that play a big role too. And this is one, you know, another proof that we didn't really learn from our history and from our project also of peace after World War II. Thank you guys so much. And well, see you next time, unless someone else has to something to add. Virginie, I don't know.
Thank you. No, thanks a lot.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.